exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Greetings, folks. This is Eco Radio Casey, and today we've got a great program lined up for you talking about diversity in the green movement, and we've got some live guests in studio with us, and we've also got a couple interviews with some people talking about a study called Green 2.0, and then in a little bit we'll come back with our news, and so stick around, stay tuned. Right now we're going to get into our interview with our first Green 2.0 guest that we talked to this weekend, and that is Whitney Tome of Green 2.0. So you'll find out more about what that is through this interview. So enjoy this and stick around. I'm speaking with Whitney Tome, an executive director with Green 2.0. And Green 2.0 is a report card dealing with aspects of diversity in the workplace of environmental nonprofits, foundations, and governmental organizations. And this is the second of these annual reports, and it was released, I believe, on January 9th. So can you tell me more about the Green 2.0 study, Whitney?
Sure. Thank you again, Dave, for having me on. Greatly appreciate it. So first off, Green 2.0 really was sort of founded and started back in 2014 to really take what was more anecdotal evidence from folks in the environmental community who said, you know, I know a lot of people of color, but didn't always know like how many of us actually were in the environmental movement. And so Green 2.0 started with a report that we commissioned by Dr. Dorcia Taylor out of the University of Michigan to actually the number of people of color that were in environmental nonprofits, foundations, and federal government agencies. And at the time, it was between about 12 and 16% were people of color. If you compare that at the time to the U.S. demographics, people of color were about 38%. And so since that time, Green 2.0 will continue to document where the progress hopefully is going, but also where recalcitrant organizations are. What we've done and what we released in January was the second report card that we've done, and this focuses on the top 40 largest NGOs and foundations based in the U.S. And so we document their demographics by staff and board to determine, you know, hopefully where we're seeing some progress, but also to identify organizations who still are unwilling to step up and make their demographics public through our wonderful partnership with GuideStar. And what I'd say is there are organizations like Oceana and the Pew Charitable Trust who are quite large and or have a great deal of resources who still aren't providing their data in an era where you see especially like, you know, technology companies and other organizations actually, you know, putting up their data either on their website or other places to show where they're making progress or where they're still having real challenges. Organizations who are unwilling to have that public conversation are still quite concerning.
It's hard to have that conversation if there's no information to base that off of.
Exactly.
So in what ways are people gaining access to this information?
One is we have a listserv, which we send it out to from Green 2.0, which usually is a few thousand people. But additionally, we have organizations like yourself, radio programs and others, and newspapers, Chronicle of Philanthropy, Inside Philanthropy, Grist. Other organizations are turning them into news stories, which has been really wonderful. And it will live and continue to live on our website. And so we're hoping to get this to as many hands as possible so people see what progress really still needs to be made in the movement. And, of course, also on social media, Facebook and Twitter, we continue to put this out as well.
And you work in the environmental field with Green 2.0. So I'm curious, what initially sparked your interest in the subject of equality in the environment?
Yeah, mine was sort of a slow trajectory. I started really working actually on oceans and fisheries issues and national parks. And what I found, especially working in oceans and fish, is I was often the only woman of color in the room. And consistently the only woman of color in the room. And it was a slow trajectory for me to recognize, like, why is that happening all the time? Should this actually be happening all the time? And then what is my role in having more women and people of color who look like me who work in this field? And so for me, it's been sort of a slow march through multiple jobs, getting more engaged. And, you know, it started my work in Environmental Defense Fund and co-chairing the diversity committee, and then taking on the role of being the director of diversity and inclusion at the National Parks Conservation Association. And now what I do with Green 2.0, and it's a recognition that I want to see more people like me in this movement, because what's perhaps not surprising is that people of color actually care about environmental issues more than whites. And this has been demonstrated through multiple polls and campaigns. And yet, we still don't take up jobs and don't have the positions of power that are needed to really transform the environmental movement. So it's the recognition that all of those things need to converge, and we really need to put people of color into seats of power.
The things that stand out in the Green 2.0 report seems to be the disparity between the full-time staff, which oftentimes is, you know, still way below the representation in the general public. Yeah, in terms of full-time staff, we have around 73% of representation from white people and 22% of people of color in full-time staff. And then when you get to senior staff, it's lower pretty much across the board in almost every organization in terms of people of color and women. So that seems to be a big gap.
Yeah, and I think that gap is perhaps the one that is most concerning and the one that we hope to change the fastest, which is the senior staff really make decisions. You know, they're the people who decide where the money and budget goes, what are the strategic priorities, and more importantly, what are potentially the problems and solutions that the environmental movement is putting forth. And we need to see more people of color in those roles, especially on the program side, not just on the administrative side, you know, HR, human resources, or, you know, chief administrative officers, which, yes, I still want people in those roles, but I also want people of color, especially in the senior vice president for programs, in the VP for strategy, because that's where we're really going to see the change. And what I think part of the challenge of the environmental movement has been is that we will continue to hire and recruit the people that we know. And a movement that especially in the 1950s and 60s was born out by middle-class whites, we continue to sort of perpetuate that bias through our hiring practices. And that's one of the places where we really have to change, because there are incredibly talented people who can do this work and are doing this work that can step into those leadership roles.
I hope this isn't too personal. Have you experienced racism or bias? What sort of experiences have you had personally that you have had to endure in the workforce?
Oh, yes. Throughout my career, I've definitely had moments like that. You know, a few very specifically, you know, I've worked especially a lot with fishermen and built some incredible relationships. And also have had some fishermen come up to me and be like, you know, something, I didn't know that you could actually handle or manage that meeting. And it was like, yes, you didn't think a woman of color who didn't look like she knew anything about fishing or didn't look like she understood what fishery management is all about could manage a room full of 100 fishermen to reach hopefully a better outcome when it comes to fishery management. So I've had moments like that. I've also had moments where I've had literally CEOs tell me that brown and black people don't care about oceans and fish. And so it happens every day because people are often unaware of the biases they have, and sometimes they come out explicitly, but sometimes they come out implicitly. And it just continues to hamper our movement's ability to really make progress and change when those biases aren't sort of confronted and addressed head on.
And just from your own experience and observations, what do you feel like are some measures that groups can take to increase diversity in the workplace?
So there are a few things that I think people can do. One is really review their hiring practices. You know, really take a strong look at how you recruit, from where you recruit, and also all stages of your interview and sourcing process. You know, how do you reach out to people and candidates? How do you build your pool? But also looking at the people you currently have in-house, and are you providing really great opportunities for promotion and retention for them, and growing them. The other thing is, like, take, you know, almost a step back and say, you know, what and why is diversity, equity, inclusion, and or justice important to you as an organization? And this means organization-wide. You know, being very clear as an institution why this matters, why it's mission critical. And then determining how then your culture, again, your hiring practices, everything you do is being impacted by either gender, race, sexual orientation, the whole nine yards, and look if it's having disparate impacts on different kinds of people just simply because of who they are. And if organizations can start there, they can really grow and develop into truly just and equitable institutions if they make that part of the core. But it really has to be led by leadership. You know, your CEO, your president, your COO, those people in sort of the senior leadership team need to be bought in and need to care about this. And you need to have a board who's willing to back you up on this and wants to engage in that same learning journey that the whole organization is undertaking.
Well, Whitney Tome, thank you so much for being here.
Delighted. Thank you.
And if people want to see the report and learn more about the great work that you all are doing to increase awareness of diversity in the environmental movement, they can go to diversegreen.org. And is there anything else that you want to share with our radio audience out there?
No, I'd just like to say thank you so much for your attention and care. And, you know, when you think about the environmental work you do, from sustainability, sort of classic sustainability, even recycling to other things, think about the impact it has on different groups of people and whether or not you are continuing to perpetuate any of those stereotypes or biases or whether you're trying to unearth them.
Thanks so much, Whitney. Justine Colma is a journalist currently writing for Grist, which is an independent news outlet dealing with sustainability, our climate, and justice. Welcome, Justine.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, let's start with the beginnings of your environmental consciousness. What initially sparked your interest in the subject of the environment?
So I really approach my environmental writing from a social justice lens. So I write on environmental and climate justice. That kind of grew out of my background as a former community organizer in California. I was working in Filipino and Southeast Asian communities. There were a lot of environmental justice issues that were faced by those communities back home, and I kind of wanted to continue probing into that. I grew up in a place that has some of the worst air pollution in the nation, and I'm really happy to now be able to go back to those places and learn more and write about what's taking place.
So you've recently published an article in Grist about the Green 2.0 Diversity Report Card. The title was The Green Movement Has a Diversity Problem. So what did you find were the most remarkable findings of this year's Green 2.0 Diversity Report?
So Grist has reported on Green 2.0's work in the past, but I think what was kind of surprising is that this is the second annual report that they put out on diversity, and it looked like the numbers were getting worse, which was surprising to me, because I know that a lot of environmental organizations have been sort of working to change that. So I was shocked to see that not only had progress not been made, but there was actually a little bit of fighting back. And there was one disparity that was that was surprising to me, which was that the number of people of color in senior staff positions at foundations had fallen pretty drastically from 33% to 4%. And although not all of the decrease was as dramatic, there was decline across the board for foundations and for the most part in the NGOs that they looked at as well.
Yeah, another remarkable thing I noticed is that the disparity between the full-time staff, so even if there is some representation among people of color or women in the full-time staff, when it jumps up to senior staff, the numbers decline in most cases, in most organizations of both women and people of color.
Right. So it's indicative of a sort of green glass ceiling there that people of color may be coming into the organizations, but they may not have as much decision-making power and roles of leadership.
So what observations have you made working in environmental reporting in terms of minority representation among environmental organizations, just your own personal observations?
Yeah, so for me as a reporter, sometimes it can be difficult for me to diversify my sources, the people that I'm talking to when I'm reporting to sort of inform my work. I do try to identify more women scientists and scientists of color and you know, the same for policymakers and advocates. And for me, that's really important because for us over at GRIST to broaden our audience and diversify our own audience, I think it's really important for communities of all different backgrounds to be able to see themselves reflected in the media that we're making. But oftentimes when I do reach out to researchers or big-name green groups, I'm not often speaking with other women of color, you know, or other women or people of color, at all, and that can make it really difficult because, you know, journalists were generally writing on a deadline, and for me to deepen my reporting and make sure that I'm being very inclusive of all of a broad range of voices takes quite a bit more time, and so it does make my reporting a little more difficult.
Have you noticed any organizations that you feel like are succeeding in terms of minority representation in the green movement?
One group that stood out to me based on the Green 2.0 report was the U.S. Climate Action Network. And they're a network of over 175 organizations taking action on climate change. And they include big groups like NRDC, the National Resources Defense Council, 350, and given the Climate Action Network, they have their own staff and board, which is a little smaller than some of the larger groups like Sierra Club or NRDC, but they did have 100% of their senior staff and two-thirds of their full-time staff were people of color last year. And for the past 2 years, 100% of their senior staff have been women, and so that looks very different than a lot of other large environmental organizations. I also noticed as I was reporting that they're very explicit about valuing social justice, equity, and diversity as critical to them achieving their mission and vision on climate change. So I think that stood out to me because when it comes to looking at, you know, who's succeeding, I guess, it's not as black and white as success and failure when we're talking about making progress on diversity. And it's a journey as much as it is a destination. It's really important to think about, you know, how we're doing the work to diversify and that we're looking at more than just numbers. You know, the numbers are important. What this report shows us is of course really important, but we also don't want to tokenize groups of people and just say that because we have this number of women or this number of so-and-so that, you know, everything's okay. It's important to ask how much representation there is in leadership and decision-making of diverse groups of people, of underrepresented communities. And then is there a culture at the organization that really supports and values that change and that values diversity and equity, I think are all key questions to ask.
Yeah, so not only are we talking about the amount of people who are actually getting jobs and being paid and, you know, having making a living off of doing doing good work, but it's also about the actions that the groups are taking and how they might serve or maybe not serve certain populations.
Right, yeah, and do folks have a meaningful seat at the table once they're inside.
I noticed you had recently written about GRIS itself and how they've done some work in terms of representation of women at GRIST. So do you feel like GRIST is representing people of color in their workplace?
I think this also falls along the lines of we're looking to continually make progress, and success is difficult to define as just one measurement. I think there's always more work that we and everyone can be doing. We do have a lot of really strong women on staff, which we're really excited about. Our CEO and our executive editor are also both people of color. With that said, we can also have more women of color and be able to look at, intersections that kind of look at both race and gender and other kind of underrepresented communities and identities that, bringing those groups into the organization. So there's always more work to be done, but we are also very clear in that we value environmental justice, equity, and diversity in our work, and that it's a central part of our, not only our reporting in the media that we're making, but in our organizational culture and, all the ways that we operate.
Yeah, we really appreciate the fact that that GRIS does so much great reporting on social justice and equity in the environmental movement and just in terms of how the environment is being affected in different communities. Yeah, how can people with interests in these issues get in touch with you or GRIST?
Yeah, so we're pretty active on Twitter. You can reach me or some of our other writers and GRIST itself on Twitter, and we also, our website has a way for folks to get in touch with story ideas. We do work with freelancers and contributors. We accept story pitches, and we also have a really great advice column called Ask Umbra that's written by my colleague Eve Andrews, who's really fantastic, and you can submit your questions to her. We would really love to interact with the folks who are reading our work and watching our videos.
All right. Well, yeah, you can find out more from GRIST at grist.org. And thank you so much, Justine, for your time with KKFI.
Thanks again for having me and for all the work that you all are doing as well around climate change, the environment, and these social justice issues.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. On the I-710 freeway in L.A., more and more diesel trucks carry goods from the city's huge port to rail yards and warehouses. For decades, the city has been considering a freeway expansion project to make room for even more traffic. But critics say that will lead to additional global warming pollution and increased health risks.
Who do you think lives along those freeways? Low-income communities of color.
Daryl Molina Sarmiento is executive director of Communities for a Better Environment. For years, the group has organized nearby communities to fight the expansion plans.
We know that communities along freeways have extremely higher risk of cancer, and so we want to see clean alternatives.
Their persistence has made a difference. Last March, transit agencies indefinitely postponed the decision to add lanes to the highway. The project is not dead, but current plans focus instead on interchange upgrades, pedestrian crossings, and funding for low-emissions trucks.
It's a people's victory because even though in the end we didn't necessarily win everything that we wanted, we still built that power and we still pushed for a better project than what was originally proposed.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Alrighty, good evening everyone. This is Richard Mabian. And I'm glad that you have tuned in to hear this show. I want you to know this is our Martin Luther King tribute. And what a better way to do it than to, in the environmental world, than to deal with the issue on the fact that the diversity within the industry itself is being quoted as being worse, getting worse. In other words, when I first got involved in the movement, it was because the first conference I attended to meet and hear David Corton in Columbus, Ohio, out of 200 people that had showed up, there was only like about 5 people of color, and only 2 of those people were black. Me and another man, and the other man didn't speak to me for the whole first day I was there. It took David Corton to break the ice to come over and start to talk to me. That's how I actually met him. Then the second conference I went to was at Berkeley, and out of 700 people, there were probably about 20 people of color there, with probably 5 of us being black from various places around the country. So I had a chance, and I even got it on video. They had me. I got up to the stage on one of the exercises they were doing where you were going to meet people. And I had this guy that was staring at me from across the room real hard, you know, like they, back when I went up to register, the lady at the desk looked at me like I was a gate. She said, "Hi, may I help you?" And I was like, "Why are you here?" And I told her I was there to register. She said, "Well, what's your name? Let me see where." And she saw my name, and so I got in. And when I got inside, I mean, it was like people were looking at me like, "Why are you here? What's going on?" And I saw this one guy, he was staring at me so hard that the first exercise was look across the room and see somebody you don't know and go over and introduce yourself to them. We're going to get to meet people. And I hightailed it straight across this ballroom to him and walked up to him and stuck my hand out, introducing myself to him and talking about some Kansas City. And this is a white guy. And he looked at me and he introduced himself to me and told me he was from Brooklyn. I went, "Brooklyn? I got black people in Brooklyn? I mean, what's up, man?" And I started realizing even in major cities, the relationship that exists between white America and a black America can be very strange. And in the environmental world, which was new at the 2000, and that was 2007. Yeah, June of 2007. It was really strange to be in rooms when you saw the numbers I'm talking about. So my next step, when they blew the whistle, whatever, they got us to move to the next person, I went up to the guy that was in charge up on the stage and pointed at him and said, "I want to deal with you." And so he got out off the stage, and I started talking to him, and I introduced myself as Richard Mabian. He said, "Richard Mabian, we've been waiting on you. David Corton told us all about you was coming," and blah, da, 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 da. And he asked me, he said, "Why are you here? What is your objective?" And I told him, "I have decided that there are so few people of color at these two conferences that I've been to, that I would like to become the national representative in this environmental movement to research the reason for the lack of people of color." And it impressed him so much, he had me get up on the stage and he said, "Y'all stop, everybody stop." He said, "This guy came up here and pointed at me and said, I want to do you." So I got down and he told me his name. And when I heard his name, I said, "Richard Mabian, this is the guy David Corton been telling us about." And then I asked him, "Why was he here?" And this is what he said. Now, I'm sitting there, you know, in California, you try to blend in with the freaky West Coast. So I got on a Hawaiian-looking shirt and a do-rag on my head. So I walked up to the mic and I told it what I told him, that I wanted to make researching the lack of people of color as my national connection to the environmental movement. Of course, you know, everybody in there, you know how y'all are. They was all happy and stuff. That got me started wanting to do that. That was in June. And between June of 2007 and November of 2007, I came back to Kansas City, formed a group with I think folks that was out of here. I know Jeff Humphill was involved, and John Kerman was involved, and we started meeting at a farmhouse over in Kansas City, Kansas, and we formed, which is now still my company, the Breaking the Silence, which is the name of the conference we put on. By November, we had a conference in Kansas City, Kansas, that at that time was the first conference that had been planned and led by a person of color. And so the thing that I did, because of my relationship with David Corton, I was able to talk him into an agreeing to come be our keynote speaker. That was unheard of in this part of the country, to get somebody like David Corton here. So he came in. Now, this is what I'm getting ready to read you. It's on my website, but I want you to hear it because this is how it went. Boy, my battery's low, so it might go out. This is David Corton, the author of The Great Turning. That's the name of his book, The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community. This was his response to my request for him to give me a statement on his reason for speaking at our first Breaking the Silence conference. He says, "Richard, you asked me to describe my intentions regarding my visit to Kansas City. In the larger sense, it is no different from my intentions wherever I visit to speak about the great turning from Earth to Empire community. It is to spread the awareness of the essential need at this distinctive time in the human experience to turn from dominator to partnership relationships as the organizing model for human society and to deepen understanding of what this requires. We cannot look to institutions of imperial domination for leadership in this great work. Such leadership must necessarily come from the broadly based popular movements that lead from the bottom. Empire maintains its power in part by controlling the prosperity, security, and meaning stories that frame the dominated culture, and in part by keeping us fragmented by race, gender, age, and class, to keep popular social movements fragmented and thereby impotent. Of these division by race remains in our nation the most intractable. We are an apartheid nation. This apartheid plays out in our progressive social movements and ultimately incapacitates them. I believe it's not the consequent or the intent of anyone in these social movements, yet there are all too few initiatives specifically devoted to multiracial dialogues on progressive issues and agendas. I'm working with groups all around the United States and Canada to engage dialogues that raise consciousness of the need to change the stories that frame the culture. With few exceptions, however, these dialogues are limited to largely white groups. This means there is little opportunity to deal with the need for interracial solidarity other than to lament the lack of it. This is why I am so energized by the Kansas City Initiative. In this initiative, the leadership is coming from community of color, and a defining purpose is to build a multiracial dialogue. This is hugely important, and I'm committed to supporting it in whatever way I am able. David." Okay, that was in 2007 that he wrote that and sent that here. And my whole existence has been pretty much discussing that issue, bringing that issue to the table. And I've been in many, many tables. I ended up being the first black board member for the Sierra Club. And you know, the conference was that People of Color Conference. Joining the NAACP, the Sierra Club was my first environmental move. My reason for joining that NAACP in Kansas City, Kansas, was to start being able to discuss or bring the environmental concerns to the table and let them be aware of the fact that that was something that was not going on in our community. And that's what I've done in the last 10 years of doing that, of making strides of trying to get across. I'm the one that found that article in Grist, and I brought it in and talked to Dave here, Dave Bennett, about it, and the other hosts about how perfect that would be for us to discuss on Martin Luther King's anniversary. This is his day, because his thing was about bringing races together and discussing ways to go about doing it. You know, when he had to deal with white America, the racist ones in the South and various places, but it wasn't white America who he saw as being the catalyst for the change, except in behaviors. He saw his time in empowering people of color and the white folks and organizations that work with him. And that's pretty much being why I'm here. I am today, and the guests that I have here with me today, God brought us together. I have to give him the credit for doing that, because that's the only other way I know we would have ever met each other. But we did, and comes to find out their commitment to their people is just as strong as my commitment to my people. And it's not about being segregated or seeing life as being a problem as much as us feeling the road to overcoming where we are is a need for us to provide opportunities for our folks, so we can use that as a training ground to prepare them for mainstream. Now I'm going to take the time to introduce you to my guests. I'm going to let them introduce themselves and tell you who and what they do. So will y'all take a couple of minutes there to do that?
My name's Jason Sutton. I'm own a construction company in Kansas City, Kansas, Sutton Remodeling. I've been in the construction company now for about a year and a half. I previously worked with a utility company for 18 years. And I'm Native American. I'm Cherokee. And I just see a real need in helping my people not only teach them how to fish, so to speak, but to, you know, learn how to catch fish and feed themselves. And I know that's an old concept, but it's still one that I believe in. I still think rings true today. And my wife is with me, and I'll let her introduce herself.
I'm Shanae Sutton, and I work with the American Indian Enterprise and Business Council. I left a wonderful job as assistant principal for a Christian school in Shawnee, but I came to this organization because I believed in its mission, and my desire is to help people. And this organization, the American Indian Enterprise and Business Council, allows us to do just that. It was formed to address a problem as it relates to the American Indian community, and I myself am Cherokee Indian. My husband and I met at Haskell Indian Nations University, and we moved up here, and we are part of this community up here, and for really a short time, but we are just loving the opportunities that we're finding and meeting people like Richard Mabian, who have that same heart to help the community. And we certainly have a preference towards Native Americans, but you know what? Our heart is to help every individual that needs to find employment, that needs some education, you know, whatever the needs are.
Training.
Yes. You know, that's what we're here to do, to help people get on their feet, put those tools in their own tool belt so that they can get out there and pass this on to the next generation.
Boy, can you believe that I ran into these two people? Those of you who know me, and those many of you listening do, you know where my heart and consciousness lies. And everything that just came out of their mouth, you know, is exactly where I am. We're not talking segregated. We're talking being in a position to bring the folks who we represent up to a point of efficiency that they don't get hired because they're black, brown, or whatever, female or whatever, to fulfill some policy or some government regulation. We want our folks to reach a point that they are so desirable behind their efficiency level that the likes of Jay Dunn and others are hiring them because of their capabilities and their professionalism. And so we figure that that's where we'll spend our time. I'm going to open up the lines because you've listened to that the first two presentations. Now you're sitting here listening to us talking. Like I said, this is our Martin Luther King tribute. And we're dealing with how we are empowering our low-income communities over finding ways to continually seek government handouts and that kind of stuff. So the number here for calling in is 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534. You're welcome to join this conversation with us, so I appreciate it. Okay. So here we are. We're working on a circumstance in Kansas City, Kansas. And at the table, we have El Centro, the leading Latino organization in this part of the country. EOF. EOF is the leading nonprofit organization, pretty much black in the black community, even though their community is becoming multicultural in the city, in the state of Kansas, and Donnelly College, the inner city four-year college, I think the only one, if I'm not mistaken, I know in Kansas City, Kansas, then pretty much the majority of their students are immigrants, and it's a tribute to be able to see the work that they do. So we had them together. I started facilitating them last year. And the thing we're working on is creating a way for us to be able to find a way to deal with a EPA program that's going to help us teach marketable skills to the people who those social service agencies serve. That's what this is about, is giving them a tool that they can start empowering the people that they serve instead of always having to deal with these outside organizations that comes to them wanting to recruit their people. We're putting them in a position where they can recruit their own people and use the money they receive to get the training that these people need. One of the things is a HAZMAT certificate has to be earned, so that way we'll be able to empower people who never had that before. Now, generationally, that's fantastic for us because now my little 14-year-old will see Uncle Bob down there getting up every morning, going out, earning some money, not standing in a line begging McDonald's to pay him $15 an hour. I'm not opposed to that. I mean, I'm not talking against the people that's doing that, but I'm saying we know, as they said, we're trying to bring dignity to the people who we serve. Tell us a little bit more about your feelings about working within your ethnic groups.
So a lot of the things that face Native Americans environmentally is lead. There's mold and asbestos, and that's one thing that we're trying to get involved in more. A lot of these environmental factors like lead, It is very detrimental to young kids. It is, you know, studies have shown over and over that that lead is a it inhibits the brain growth, and we've got to help these children overcome this problem, so that they can have a fair chance at, you know, increasing their life and their potential in life. So that's something that we're really looking into, you know, to take over and try and help our communities.
Well, you know, one of the things during the Civil Rights days, that we learned in citizen participation, and now they refer to it as community engagement, you know, when you do something like, okay, remediation. Okay, we're talking about we're hiring people that start working in your company that will go out where you get contracts to do mold removal and those kind of things. The kitchen table in most homes, but I'm speaking specifically in low income home, is the throne, other than the bathroom. That's your throne. And when you in there with your matriarchy kinds of life that we live in the low income communities, that's where your conversations come out. So if you got a person that's working for you, that's dealing with the removal of lead and mold, and they're coming home talking about their daily experiences, that's bringing a conversation to the kitchen dining room table, kitchen table, that can be a benefit to the homes. What you just said about the damage and dangers of that is can have way more positive effect on the people we're trying to reach over someone trying to come in the house with a suit on to talk to you about lead. Yeah. You understand? Because now it's somebody that you know and you realize this is not just some gimmick. This is something that's real. And at the same time, you got your children. They're hearing it. And so this is the generational part I'm talking about. So now maybe we can find ways for the school to start tapping in to the kids, because now this is something they didn't heard Uncle Bob or Cousin Billy talking to their mama about. And in the process of doing that, that's empowering them to become conscious about it. And then when they grow up, it becomes a way of life because they can raise their kids. That's what this whole thing is about. And you people who are listening, I want you to understand, that's what our whole process is about. For us to be able to establish the type of inclusiveness that needs to be involved in the environmental reason. There's no way, the one thing I learned with my time with David Corton, in order for this environmental movement to work, it has to be inclusive.
Yeah.
Across the board. You can't have Johnson County living life as a supreme and then people in the inner city are living life in hell. That doesn't benefit the planet. If we're going to benefit the planet, it has to be across the board. All of us are striving to create a mental concept that will bring us to a point where we can achieve the kind of environmental literacy that's needed.
Right, Richard. And that's why Jason and I have designed a training program to pull these people in from the community to give them training opportunities. And I'd like for Jason to explain that just a little bit.
Well, basically, you know, you mentioned inclusiveness and it's hard for some people that are from the reservation and from the neighborhoods and communities that we're discussing here to trust outsiders or to trust people of not of color to come in and tell them, you know, that, oh, you're living in poverty and you have these problems. Well, we know that. We understand that. Well, this training program is to help empower our individual people. We're looking for people that are serious, that they not only want to help others, but help themselves as well. It's important, you know, that we take accountability ourselves. We're the ones that's going to pick us up out of this. It's not the government. It's not the administration, this, that, or the other.
Right.
It's us.
Right.
We are the ones that are going to be able to pull ourselves out of this. So this training program we're looking at is a kind of a disaster response training program. We'd like to teach people mold and moisture mapping, mold inspection. And then when large hurricanes or large disasters strike, we take groups of people, we go down, and we inspect buildings and inspect places. Now, when other people in the community see these people going out and taking care of other communities, and then they're coming back and they're sharing their stories, you know, it gets people excited. Wow, these people are really doing something here. These people are making a difference, not just here in Kansas City, but in Houston and in Louisiana and North Carolina. And that's what we want to do. We want to give people skills. and dignity to do these things.
And you know, Martin Luther King was real big on love, sharing the love. And so what do you do when you take these people and you put them in communities that you see the disaster? It really does pull a sense of compassion out of you to help others.
Right. I agree 100%. I was explaining to someone today that one thing we've created is this 50-year pathway out of poverty. Hmm. See, I tell stories sometimes. I say that as far as slavery is concerned, a Monday we were slaves, Tuesday we were free. And Wednesday, we were expected to go back to the same person we had been slaves for and ask for a job. Well, what happened is we never got a chance to learn independence, you know. We never had a break there to come off of being slaveries. And even into this day, we're still looking at the man. We're still looking for somebody else to create that mechanism we need in our life to take us forward, to create prosperity. And you know and I know that the way the system is, just like David Corton was saying, it's designed, that dominator culture is designed to keep us fragmented, keep us separated. They keep white people scared to be around black people because all they do with black people is the system shows you black people doing dumb things. I'm not giving them no hustle. I mean, dumb things. You never hear about people doing what we doing. Right. You never hear how this is something maybe I could attach myself to and say we can build this. You heard me just name off a black poverty program, a El Centro, a Latino program. Here I'm sitting here with you two, Native Americans.
Yes.
Here we are trying to do our damnedest to create the kind of relationships that we need as Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You understand what I'm saying?
Exactly.
But we don't get that support mechanism out of it. We get the conversations about how bad white he is and how he and how that's what they think we think.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And I'm not, like I said, giving any hustle to the people that do the dumb things. They scare me as much as they do anybody. But at the same time, we're not sitting down in these trenches letting dirt grow over our feet. We all are out here trying to figure out ways to make it better. But we need society's help in giving us the encouragement and support we need. And that's what I think when we come in here for Martin Luther King. His issue was within the black community of empowering people to stand up for yourselves and be heard, reach out for opportunities that this country has to give you. When he came to white America, he was saying, look, this is what we want. Look at what they're doing to us. They beating us down. They treating us all as if we just worthless people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we are now.
Yeah.
That's why the article was saying it's getting worse, because the stereotypical view is keeping people from wanting to have anything to do with the people who look like us, which includes us.
Right. That mentality stops people from taking the opportunities that are right in front of them.
Right.
This is a great opportunity for anyone, and we want to encourage people to you know, think outside the box. Don't sit there and say, well, this is all I know, so I'm comfortable right here. Sometimes you have to get knocked off center.
Right.
You know?
And I think, too, giving those opportunities helps change the mindset.
Yes.
And, you know, we really see this generation, the younger generation, the generation of our children, their mindset is different than how we were raised. And, you know, you see a lot of them are really almost afraid to work. Maybe they don't want to give up their free time, you know, but work, you know, really we were created to work.
Right.
And the first job ever was to tend the Garden of Eden, you know, that God gave Adam to tend to. Well, you know, if we change that mindset of the generation coming up, then, you know, we're actually giving them a sense of freedom.
Right.
And, you know, and just, I just wanted to throw this in that I didn't think about until the other day that, my senior year in high school, I won second place in the state of Oklahoma in an essay contest that was Martin Luther King Jr.'s Riches of Freedom. And I had forgotten about that completely. But, you know, when I was thinking about that, that when you have that freedom to choose the work, to go to work, to feed your family, you know, all of those, there is such richness in that.
Well, one thing that I first of all, me going into the from college, you know, y'all know, those who know me, you know, I was a easy rider hippie also. You know, my era in school was doing that part of life. I graduated from college in 71 after coming back from the Vietnam thing. And my reason for, I was teaching special education, and my reason for moving into the inner city to get involved in community organizing was because I said I heard the beat of a different drummer. I heard black leaders back in that era saying that they had died, they had people that had died and gone to jail. Martin Luther King and the rest of them, this is like 71, he died, Martin Luther King died in 68, who had died and gone to jail to fight to open doors for people like myself and others, young folks coming along. And they were getting these doors open that were providing us with opportunities that people of color, black people, had never had before. And once they got their degrees, they all left the inner city. The things that they had been fighting to get people to open up doors for, they couldn't find a way to come back in the inner city to work. And we're still there now. And I'm not knocking the people who have been able to be successful. General Motors is a good example in Wyandotte County. They would hire people out of the inner city and start working. And as soon as they get a few paychecks up under their belt, they move.
Yeah.
They move. And so here you are. You just have nothing but people who are down on their luck, that are still there down on their luck. I don't think I know of anybody else in Wyandotte County who does what I do. That's unreal. Yeah. I don't know how many Native Americans you would know that do what you do. No. All right, I got the word that we got down to a minute. I hope you all who have listened on this have enjoyed hearing a conversation that's coming from the likes of us. So I want to give them a chance. We only got about 30 seconds left, not that much time, but time to say goodbye to folks. And
just thank you for the opportunity. You guys have a beautiful building here. Thank you for everything.
Yes, and if you're looking to get involved in the community, check out our website, American Indian Enterprise and Business Council.
That's what we wanted. Thank you, gang. And to those of you who are out there, I know Mike is out there. It's some Martin Luther King kind of a celebration. Enjoy yourself.
Now the calendar of events for the week of January 21st. The Powell Garden staff will teach a behind-the-scenes greenhouse workshop from 9 a.m. to noon on Monday, January 21st, at the Botanical Gardens Greenhouse, 1609 Northwest U.S. Highway 50, Kingsville, Missouri. Register at Powell Gardens. The Heartland Conservation Alliance will host a Martin Luther King Nature Walk at 1 p.m. on Monday in Kansas City. A trained naturalist will lead the 1.5-mile walk that begins at the Martin Luther King Square Park, 1800 Swope Parkway, and winds along Brush Creek Parkway to the Bruce R. Watkins Cultural Center. Parking will be available at the park, and a shuttle will return walkers to the parking lot. Organizers said it will take place regardless of the weather. All ages are welcome. Welcome to attend. Refreshments will be served at the end of the walk. For more information, go to Heartland Conservation Alliance. The Kansas Women's Environmental Network will focus on local and statewide challenges at a forum on environmental issues at its annual meeting from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. on Tuesday, January 22nd at the Baker Wetlands Discovery Center, 1365 North 1250 Road, Lawrence, Kansas. Speakers include Eileen Horn, Kansas State Representative, Jasmine Moore, Lawrence and Douglas County Sustainability Director, and Makokwa Jones, Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation. For more information, contact kwenleadership@gmail.com. January 24th, 6:30 to 8 p.m., Last Wild Places in Kansas author George Frazier will discuss native geological formations that defy the flat stereotype of Kansas. This will be at Johnson County Library Branch Library, 4700 Town Center Drive, Leawood, Kansas. Call 913-826-4620 or email jocolibrary.org. Learn how to grow a pollinator-friendly garden and ward off diseases, weeds, and critters at the Community Garden Workshop. This half-day event will be held from 8:30 a.m. to noon on Saturday, January 26th, at the Olathe Community Center, 1205 East Kansas City Road, Olathe, Kansas. Call 913-715-7000 for more information. Sunday, January 27, the Earth Care Forum 2019, beginning at 9:40 a.m. at First Presbyterian Church, 2415 Clinton Parkway. The topic will be Imagining an Equitable and Just Transition to a Clean Energy Future for Kansas, presented by Rachel Masilvi, Assistant Director of Climate Energy Project. For volunteer events in recycling and tree planting at bridgingthegap.org, go online. These items and more can be viewed on the Eco Radio KC Facebook page and at the kkfi.org Eco Radio KC program page.
When going with the flow makes economic sense. On this current cast. Thousands of dams across the U.S. harness rivers to reap a variety of goods and services. But as those dams age, their owners can face